The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. R.L. Stevens is an organizer in Chicago, the founding editor of Orchestrated Pulse, and the A. Philip Randolph Fellow at Jacobin. His essay, Between the Black Body and Me, was published in May at Viewpoint Magazine and is the topic for this week's Zero Books podcast. It's Wednesday, July 5th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Angela Nagel's book and Joanna Demmer's book are both available. Angela Nagel's book would be Kill All Normies, and Joanna Demmer's book is Anatomy of Thought Fiction. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is a Vaporwave remix of Anya's Only Time. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to R.L. Stevens and I discuss Beyond the Black Body. R.L. Stevens is an organizer in Chicago, founding editor of Orchestrated Pulse, and the A. Philip Randolph Fellow at Jacobin.
That's right.
His essay, Between the Black Body and Me, was published in May at Viewpoint Magazine and then republished at Jacobin. And we'll be discussing this essay on this episode of the Zero Books podcast. R.L. Stevens, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Before we started recording or before the interview started, I mentioned, and I'll mention it again now, that my son Ben, who is 20 and at university, and actually involved with the DSA, was very excited to hear that I was going to be interviewing you. It's one of the few people he had heard of before.
That's tight.
Yeah.
What up, Ben?
Yep. So, but before we get into these big questions, I should just give you an opportunity to maybe add to your bio for people who don't know you already. If you have.
Yes. Yeah. So, currently I've worked for Unite Here for some time as a campaign strategist and researcher. And then that was before I moved to Jacobin. And when I moved to Jacobin, that's when I began being involved in DSA. And that's been a real experience, or a great experience for me so far, in the sense of like giving me a space to test out the ideas that I've been talking about on the old website I used to run, Orchestrated Pulse, as well as, you know, the ideas that I'm talking about when I'm writing articles for Jacobin now. And I believe, like, if there's one thing that I would like people to understand about me, or about more specifically about my work, it's that I'm exploring ideas with the express purpose of using them. I think that's rather novel these days, actually. But and it shouldn't be. All the things that I'm writing, if you look at my whole catalog going back to, you know, 2011, when I was involved in the Occupy moment, I was 23 when that all jumped off, and I was publicly involved in it. My entire record is just me trying to figure out what to do. Okay, and then once I do something, I think about like, okay, well, what happened? So, and what was the impact? I'm a reflexive person. I believe, not in the Maoist sense per se, like in terms of self-create or struggle sessions and the like, but I do believe that, a degree of candor, and I hope it comes off as humility in like why I'm trying to criticize these ideas or I'm trying to penetrate these concepts. I'm really talking to myself also.
Yeah.
I hope that's clear for people.
You know, I people who listen to my podcast regularly have probably heard me say what I'm about to say a lot of times, but I'm going to say it again. In 2008, when the economic crisis happened, I was already a middle-aged jerk, but, I was in my 30s. But I realized that my politics needed to change because I didn't understand what was happening in the world. And so I started a podcast then that ended up being this podcast eventually, and it was all aimed at trying to teach myself and understand what was happening, hopefully so that I could do something with that information. I think you're probably much better at doing something with the ideas that you support than I am. Although, you know, I do publish and things, but yeah, whenever I talk to someone in the DSA, I feel guilty. As I said, my son is in the DSA. He's doing that work for me, you know.
That counts. Totally counts. Okay.
All right. So, the one thing you mentioned was that you try to be humble. And I wonder if part of the reason you're saying that is because in this particular piece, you took on Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is very well loved and respected. Did you get some flack for this?
No, piece? I guess, I mean, it's more of an internal dialogue that I'm having with myself about like what I don't, or why I say that these things are humble is or come from a place of humility, is that I am saying like hard, I'm drawing hard lines in the analysis. I'm saying this is wrong, don't do it, you know? But like the motivation for that is this like deep compassion for other people and a concern for like where I'm going to be putting my own energies with them. And so like that's what creates the fervor for me and the passion for like why I'm saying don't follow these lines of argument, because we will lose. And I'm tired of losing. And I'm speaking to you as someone who's out here trying to do it with you, not like just like trying to have a career, as like a public intellectual or something. That's what I think humility is. Like to me, humility is important for the work because it's not self-deprecation. I'm very much so trying to have power out here in these streets. I'm totally unapologetic in that. I am all about getting power and destroying the enemy. But humility is really what it means to me, is an appreciation for other people being in the struggle with you, other people's talents and skills and abilities. And so like, I don't want people to conflate the harshness with which I can sometimes criticize an idea or a persona. Like, I don't have anything against Ta-Nehisi Coates, like specific, like as a dude. It's like the persona and his function within the cultural industry and his impact on people that I'm trying to organize that like frustrates me. And so like that's the spirit, and that's like what's coming. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, couple of thoughts. When I mentioned Ben, my son, who's at University of Oregon, and last year when he started, there was a day of induction. So all the parents and the students went and sat around and listened to lectures and things. And part of it was every student who was new to the university received a copy of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me. And I thought it was odd, not so much that everyone would get a book, but that it was a book that was apart from any course, that it was a book that people were meant to read on their own and absorb rather than study or, you know, think about critically. And so that kind of bothered me. It also, I was a little jealous as a publisher. It's like, I wondered how could I get one of our authors to be one of these people who everybody got a copy of their book when they got to university. But I wonder if Ta-Nehisi Coates, the fact that, I guess my question is, do you think the fact that Ta-Nehisi Coates is not really received critically has something to do with the fact that he's also, his work hasn't had what you think of as a positive influence on activism.
Yeah, I mean, I think he writes in a way that, let me say it this way. Part of the project in the essay is to try to acknowledge that he speaks to the physicality, the brutality of racism, and does so in a way that's that relies on metaphor and description, which oftentimes people don't do. And so they find it refreshing, right, to have this what some would consider to be a poetic portrayal of the brutality. And a sort of emotional candor and proximity. So you, when you read his work, and I've read a lot of his work, he's similar to me in that regard, in that there's an emotional tone to how he's engaging the work. I think, and I can appreciate that. And I appreciated it more early, like years ago, when I hadn't developed as much both in terms of practical organizing experience, nor had I developed as much theoretically. So once I began learning more and doing more, I began to see through some of the rhetorical strategies and techniques that he was employing, and to see the actual ideology, to see the function of the work he was creating, and begin to tear that apart. So, so what do I mean by that specifically? Well, if you read the article, I'm talking about a lot of things, but I'm really trying to juxtapose the idea that one can embrace the brutality and the barbarity of racism, without having to resign to fatalism. Like, that to me is like the central tension. That's the idea behind his work. It's this kind of resignation to inertia. And it manifests in some bizarre ways. So I think the one that was stuck out, there are two in particular stuck out to me the most. It was his description of climate change, and I had to tone it down. Oh man, I had to tone down this portion of the essay, because again, like, I'm not trying to like beef or like, you know, I'm not trying to insult the man for real, you know. Yeah. I'm trying to talk about, critique the work, right?
Yeah.
So I pulled some of this out, but the way he describes climate change as being sort of a final solution, you know, like that the dreamers, aka white people, have by the product of their like desire to have slaves create the suburbs and the highway system to get away from those former slaves, now black people who live in these inner cities. And so that has in turn created like the deathbed, you know, climate change is the noose around the neck of the world. It'll be the deathbed of us all. You know, he uses all this like really, really dramatic language to describe climate change as being purely a product of like a polluted white consciousness. That's why the only point he can see in political work, black political work in particular, is to awaken the dreamers. That is to arouse their consciousness, because he believes that's where the problem lies. And so he's applying that analysis to an issue like climate change. So I'm like reading this, and this is in the end of the book. So this is like what he wants the takeaways to be. I'm reading this and I'm like, bruh, come on. Like, if we want to be serious about climate change, I had this section where I was like, look, I believe it's 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions on the planet are just like the result of like, industrial slaughter, meaning cows farting. Okay, okay. Cattle flatulence is like it has more of an impact on the greenhouse gas emissions than like planes, cars, all of that combined. That's like a fact. Yes, this is something that I read. You know, I'm like, dang, really? Like, so cows hate black people? Is that like? You can't use this framework to explain the world. Like, you can't say that climate change is the result of, like, white people's negrophobia trying to get away from black people. Look at China. China is one of the world's leading polluters. Are they trying to get away from black people? No. Like, this, there are, like, 10 black people in China. Let's keep it real. Okay? So, like, it's not, you cannot reduce. People talk about class reductionism. I think for the most part, that's like a slur almost. Like, it's just ridiculous. It's a distortion. But race reductionism is definitely a thing. You cannot reduce the whole of capitalist enterprise to white people's consciousness and an antagonism between black and white. It cannot be reduced to that. The whole of economic input is not reducible to that struggle. And when you think that way, it's because you refuse to take seriously class, and you don't know what it is. So, like, I find that most people who talk about class are talking about socioeconomic status. And that is such a narrow perception of what class is, to the point of distorting any reasonable understanding or utility for the concept. So, like, if you have a serious or rigorous understanding of what class is, and you understand relations and productive forces and the material, you know, base and the superstructure, and then you understand that, like, race functions as an ideology. And this is getting into this, the part two of the essay that I've been, like, trying to write.
Let me just make a comment or two. So, yeah, one thing that I noticed there is I don't think that the story about, the white fear of black people even fully explains the, you know, development of the suburbs.
Right. Which is World War II. Like, where do you, it's like, why are, like, I read a stat in high school. They put out this stat that was like one in 5 miles of the highway system is like straight, so that you can, like, land planes on it, you know, because it's part of the military industrial, complex. So that can, again, how is that explained? Like, you cannot reduce it to just this, like, negrophobia, you know? So that's, yeah.
Nice house, isn't it?
Sure, it's nice. And if I'm lucky, after I get out, in 5 or 10 years, I'll have one pretty much like it.
Well, George Tobin, just driving in, didn't have to wait any 5 or 10 years. As soon as he got out of the Navy, he applied to the Director of Finance, Veterans Administration in Washington. And they were able to help him get a loan by guaranteeing it up to $2,000. Of course, George, like every veteran, had to meet certain conditions, prove he was a reliable citizen. But he was able to do that all right.
Well, I guess I was all wrong about it being like last time. But wait a second. What about the beautiful blonde? Don't tell me the GI Bill of Rights guarantees every returning serviceman one of those, too.
No, that's still up to the veteran. Just as it's up to him to take advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and not expect the government to come after him.
There was all sorts of reasons for investment in the suburbs, one of which was, you know, there was actually some effort to house workers after World War II, and the, you know, there was development of Levittown and things like that in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
That. But that doesn't mean that, you know, white flight didn't happen. It totally did, right?
Yes. So, right. But you cannot reduce even white flight to being purely about white people's polluted, dirty minds. Okay. So even white flight is about property relations. You gotta talk about class. Like, you have to talk about the class society as being the context in which the ideologies of race, in which the practice of racism has meaning. It's a tool within this context. And, like, that is what I'm trying to push people to understand, is that, like, you cannot have this reductive understanding. And it's so seductive, because he talks about the brutality and the depravity in such a detailed way that it makes you feel, it evokes a feeling. So that's why I wanted to focus on Fannie Lou Hamer, is like, and to focus on the legacy of black people who fought for something, actually telling stories of brutality and depravity to each other, not to resign themselves to fatalism, but to struggle and resist.
You know, at Zero Books years ago, when there were a different group of publishers, there was a book they published Capitalist Realism by Mark Fisher. And after that book was published, Mark wrote a book, an essay called Exiting the Vampire Castle, which was all about trying to reframe or understand, you know, identity politics. And in that essay and he made a lot of good points. But in that essay, though, he treats class, I think, very much in that same style, like a class is an identity position based on your socioeconomic status. It's being a worker, being worried about workers and poor people's rights, rather than, as you're describing it, class being just, you know, that, but also a whole system of production and property relations as well. So I just want to underscore that even people who are trying to embrace class as an important topic sometimes miss the boat and go just to that socioeconomic.
Yeah, they're not trying to actually describe society. Like, that is why class analysis is important. It's like only if it's taken up as a means for like really saying this is how we believe society works. That's how I'm talking about class, is that I believe that there are these class relations that are part of like the base and like all of this stuff, this is just classic Marxist stuff that like helps you to understand even the specificity of different experiences that you're having. So that's part of why, and this, you know, this might be a little controversial, but I'm preparing to talk about this at the socialism conference. So I'm gonna give you some exclusive content right here.
All right, great.
Totally brand new. I haven't like really gotten into dealing with this, but part of the reason why I'm critical of intersectionality is for the same reasons. It's that it treats race, class, gender, disability, all of these things as being co-equal, like linear. Well, co-equal is not the word I want to use. Being co-linear. And so it's not consistent with my understanding of a base and superstructure explanation. That's how the intersection functions. It's a base and superstructure. That's the that's my form of materialist analysis.
There's a category mistake in intersectionality, especially when you start to put race, gender, sexual orientation, and then class all in a line, like these are the same things. Like,
yeah,
it's like you're saying, yeah, apples, pears, oranges, and grocery stores, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So because they're reducing class to merely socioeconomic status and the like. And that's clear, even, and this is going to be controversial at the panel, at the socialism conference coming up in July, because they're taking up the Combahee River Collective and like talking about this. But it's clear that they have a distortion of Marxist analysis, even in the Combahee River Collective statement. If you read that statement, they say, well, we are essentially in agreement with Marx as it relates to the specific conditions and specific time that he spoke of. But we need to develop some new theory to understand our position as Black women. And I'm like, Marx was not commenting on a specific time and specific. This brother was talking about, he was trying to theorize the world, and he was trying to create a historical materialism that stretched beyond his specific time. Like, that's the purpose of his project. So why are you saying this? And then like that's why I say that it's incompatible with Marxism. That's why I'm saying there is no intersectional Marxism, because like, You are rejecting the idea of you're rejecting that materialist analysis that says that describes just how exactly ideologies like race and practices like sexism and the like actually relate to the social reproduction of our society. You know, there's a specific way in which they relate. That's what we believe as Marxists, right? And so you've pivoted away from that to have this like collinear matrix of domination that treats classes more as socioeconomic status than a material base. And that is like why it doesn't work and why it's perfectly compatible with Kimberly Crenshaw's application when she's trying to deal with the rigidly conservative, okay, legal system which treats race as an immutable characteristic, something that it is fundamentally not. Okay, but the legal system in anti-discrimination law has to do that. That's how the system works. And she's trying to combine different categories while not challenging the immutability assumption in order to make different claims within that fundamentally conservative system. And this tool called intersectionality, which does not challenge
what kind of bird is that you got?
I don't even know. Yeah, I got birds all in here. I'm at my house.
You had like a pet bird. I didn't know.
The bird is just outside. I'm in the sunroom. My roommate just got back. I'm telling you, man, I'm not big time out here. I'm not big time. Okay. I am just a dude trying to make sense of the struggle, you know? So I'm just at my house.
How is it that bit from legal theory that Crenshaw put together, which I think was right. I mean, like her arguments about intersectionality in a legal context when it comes to discrimination cases seems absolutely right to me. I mean, there's no question.
I actually disagree with it.
Well, in law, like if you're going into the courts and you're trying to determine whether, say, for instance, black women are discriminated against, in some company, and they say, no, look at all these black men we have in the warehouse. We're not discriminating against these black women. It's important to say, look, no, you're not discriminating against them as black people only. You're discriminating against them as black women. I think that makes sense.
Well, I think it's baked into the theory, or, well, some people say it's not a theory. Some people say it's just a concept. Some people say it's just a framework. Like, there's a lot of confusion as to what even intersectionality is. But like, let's just talk about the Crenshaw piece for a moment. That when I say that I have some degree of disagreement with even the legal interpretation, and now I am no legal expert or scholar. I just graduated from law school, but even when I was in school, I was only interested in politics. Like, I quickly learned that if we're trying to change the society, this is not the ticket. So,
right.
But I had to, one of the really great things that I took away from that experience was learning a great deal about how anti-discrimination law functions, particularly in the realm of employment. I looked at the cases that she cites in her work. And one of the cases, like, you're talking about, you know, a handful of people in the difference between one or two positions. Okay. But what's interesting about that, and she cites, like I said, three main cases as a case study. One of the cases, the judge says, if we take up the line, if we take up this argument, right, it's just going to lead to a bunch more categories that people can make. So it'll be like, oh, you have black women here, but you don't have black, queer, disabled women here. And then why can't that be a claim? You know, so then that's what the judge says. And the judge predicted, like, I mean, that is precisely what happened in the activist space, in which it's become a quest for centering on a perfect subject, one that is most, it's assumed is most representative of all struggle. So a queer, black, disabled woman in poverty, and what, you know, all of these things has to be centered
mentally ill.
Yeah. Has to be centered in order for the politics to have meaning. And I'm like, I don't think that's how we need to do it. Like, that is, I believe, consistent with this kind of neoliberal, hyper-individualistic conception of society. Rather, we have to build, because the politics required to remedy any of this. Let's set aside, like, what your theory of identity is and how they, you know, set all that aside. The politics necessary to remedy it are fundamentally collective. Okay. It requires people to work together across identities, however you conceptualize said identities. So we need theories that actually incentivize that type of work and discuss how systems of power actually function rather than getting bogged down into trying to center a kind of moralistic response, which tries to center politics on a perfect subject rather than explaining how the world works, finding coalitions necessary to defeat it, to defeat and change, defeat challenges and to change the way that world works in terms of subjugating people. There's a fundamental like dis, it's part of the collapse of communism and all of that. Like the failures to do that universal project have produced a variety of theories, intersectionality being one of them, Afro-pessimism being another, that really, really does not believe in the collective, actually. Does not believe because of the failures of that particular communist state communist project. And I think like we have to understand that in that context. So I just wrote an article about Tupac, in fact, that just came out yesterday that talks about that, that says like the collapse of communism, the collapse of revolutionary movements around the globe left a revolutionary. Tupac was for real from a revolutionary family. Okay. Like his stepfather is Assata Shakur's brother, and he broke her out of prison in 79. And that's why she's even in Cuba to begin with. Okay. Like that is Tupac's family. That is that is where he's coming from. That's what he was trying to do. But the movements collapsed all around him, leaving him isolated and, you know, paranoid and all kinds of stuff, you know? So I think Tupac is actually an example or a representative of what's happened, not just discursively to the left, but what's functionally happened in the time since, and just in my lifetime, even as far as being lost, as far as not having a collectivity to even believe that collectivity is possible, reduction to like the individual and just a lack of like support and guidance. And I think you're seeing those problems manifest time and again, in various activist projects that people take up, whether it be Occupy, which I'm very clear, like we fail. You know, there was a guy, I was in New York and DC. In DC, there were homeless people that lived in that park before we got there. One of them was named Bear. Bear is this white dude with a huge beard, looked like Santa Claus, okay? My guy Bear died in the park after Occupy was over, and nobody knew he was dead or claimed his body for, I believe, 4 months after he died. Like, in the very park that we used to occupy.
How did a body stay in that park for four months?
No, he didn't. Not the body didn't stay in the park. I'm saying they found him, but nobody knew. Nobody claimed him, you know what I'm saying? No. They didn't leave his body in the park. I'm saying he did. None of us knew he was dead. Nobody cared for him. Like, no. So we had all of these experiences together. But like that to me captures just like how much we failed to change the world. Like we had a moment where we brought people, you know, I was in law school, Bear was homeless. Like we, you know, there were all these different types of people doing this thing, trying to change the world. And we failed. And that failure manifests in deaths. I can't tell you how many people that I hung out with at Occupy died of drug overdoses, suicides, all kinds of things just in the, you know, 5 years since we demobilized.
Was it mostly homeless people that had that happen, or was it students?
It's some homeless people. There are people who are like into that lifestyle too. I don't know. There's a variety of different types of people, you know? And that like, those are the stakes though. That's why I have such a passion and fervor for like trying our best to get this thing right. Because if we don't, people continue to die. Okay. Needlessly. All right. So like, that was why when I wrote an article in 2015, when I went to Baltimore the day after the riots out there, and I was handing out food in the streets, right? We were organizing this food distribution thing at a church because almost all the kids in that in Baltimore get free lunch, right? It's incredibly poor. And people were scared to like walk in the streets. And we had to do a lot of organizing just to get people to understand, like, you can't just ask people to come to the church and get this food. Like, we have to take the food to the community. This is an organizing challenge. We need to go out there and mix with the people. That's what that's you claim that's what you're here to do. So then let's go do it. And you got to stop being scared of our of the people, you know. So I remember I did an interview with Doug Hinwood like 3 months after that in August 2015. And I was saying that like the challenge here was like BLM was hot. And at that point, like D-Ray and Netta and them were still like associated with the Black Lives Matter thing. There hadn't been all these splits and stuff. But I was saying that like they were there, but they like these, you know, movement celebrities, but that didn't actually translate to being able to organize anything. So, and I saw that in real time because Netta showed up to the church where we had been like having to, it took us 45 minutes just to get people to stop being scared of going outside. Okay. So Netta arrived after that though, and she didn't pack a single lunch or like rally the people, do anything that would help build a movement of any kind. Like no leadership development, no, like nothing. So I'm like, what? It's just about it, all the work is centered on the individuals and on like, on just like the moment. Even if it is about a group, it's always momentary. It's the same thing with Occupy, you know, like it was the moment, and we weren't able to build long-term collective projects that made sense. And I think like there are a lot of people that have suffered because of that. Because when you commit yourself to an activist project, and this is why I don't consider myself an activist anymore. When you commit yourself to these moments, though, you sacrifice a lot. And a lot of these people, there was an article that just came out about BLM. A lot of these people end up not having jobs, struggling to eat day to day. Like there aren't structures in place to develop leaders and support collective work, right? And to make sure that it's sustainable. And I think these theories like Afro-pessimism, intersectionality, what have you, are a reflection of that type of world where collectivity, where the kind of radical collectivity, the kind of movement, even if it's not radical, the kind of like, even progressive collectivity we're at a low point, and it just started to get kicked up in the last 10 years or so. Can we engage in the serious work of developing long-term, strategically guided, tactically smart collective projects that support one another and actually make resistance go beyond like a defensive measure to being something that can be paradigmatic, that can be socially transformative. And that's the goal as far as I'm concerned. And that's so why I write.
When Occupy was happening, like I was really interested. I was here in Portland. I went down to Occupy Portland a few times, but I was also already doing a podcast at that point. I'd been doing it for a couple of years, and I've been talking to a lot of Marxists before Occupy even started happening, because I was trying to figure out why the economic crisis was going on. So, and when Occupy started happening, I was talking to a few Marxists and I said, is your group, because there's all these little sectarian Marxist groups, right? Like, is your group going to go down to Occupy? Are you wanting to, like, you know, bring these ideas to this movement? And the answer was basically no. You know, there was this, like, no, that's not a good area for us to, you can't really do theory in the park, that kind of thing. And I was like, well, but I felt like in that moment that if there had been, if people had been picking up Marx and saying, we need to really think about what class is and what this economic crisis is, because that's what got us out here.
Okay, cool. I'm going to try to get away from this window. My roommate coming back has put these. Give me 1 second. Yeah. Okay. So I'd say there, you know, you said that these groups said that you couldn't do theory in a park. I feel like that's all we did for the most. We were theorizing a lot of stuff out there. We had a lot of like unsustainable what we called actions, you know, that like required us to basically be the warm bodies for other people's agendas. So we would like show up and protest this. We were basically like protest for hire without any pay. So, so there definitely was that component, but we spent a huge amount of time theorizing this and that. And there were certain tendencies that were dominant, like anarchism and other ideas. What happened was when the project failed, the theoretical explanation was that it wasn't intersectional enough. Like it failed because, and this was in my experience, like the idea was that it failed because it could not take up the issues of particular forms of oppression seriously. So then first that manifested in this kind of anti-oppression framework, which is kind of like it's a moralistic interpersonal kind of code, which kind of people talk about as like call out culture or whatever. So I was part of that. And then I was thinking, I don't know about this. Like as my life conditions changed and I wasn't a student anymore, you know, and I've talked about this in the Chapo episode, I found myself in situations in which I could not check the privilege of these white people around me. Like the theories or the concepts, the frameworks weren't useful in a world in which we were not in peer relationship, where these white people or whomever has power, actually has power over me. Because these frameworks didn't capture motion. They didn't capture the actual, because they didn't have a class component really, other than like, you know, understanding that like it was socioeconomic status or whatever. It was this kind of amalgamation of like different pieces of specificity that they believed represented a whole rather than actually providing tools to fight or to say we need collective strength. It's not about me being able to call you out. It's about actually building a political program to which you will be accountable. And that's the foundation for checking shit or well stuff. Yeah, sorry.
Right. No,
that's
no,
the foundation.
We're not on the radio.
And they didn't want to do that work. I didn't know how to deal.
Give me a concrete example. So you're like, you're on the job and your boss is being a dick and kind of racist and calling him out isn't an option. But also,
that's right.
Even if you did, let's say you got him to apologize, it might not change anything in terms of like how the policies are being implemented or what your conditions are on the job, right?
Right. And then now even if there are shifts in the world at large, which create opportunities for an individual to be able to like in my experience, like coming from the family that I came from, whereas like, you know, my mom worked in white spaces and she would chin check these white people all the time. Like she'd be like, yes, I'm wearing this West African outfit at work and you better not say a thing. You know, that was my mom, you know, but like there were certain, it was a different moment. Okay. And that did not ultimately work to change the conditions of racism. And like, so I've seen this in the managerial context because that's the type of family I come from. I come from managerial class black people. My dad was a preacher and my mom, was a manager in the nonprofit sector. So I saw what it looked like to be able to successfully contest at an individual level the biases and attitudes of so-called oppressors, you know? But why my parents failed and like, let me say it this way. I also saw the toll that it took on them personally and on me by extension. And I saw that it did not actually change the conditions for black people as a whole it did not address any of the things that were fundamentally collective problems that required collective struggle. And they did not know how to actually organize that. So I did not realize that all of that until I was in these situations and I couldn't rely on the kind of the life history of just through sheer force of will being able to push back on things that people are doing to me. And I couldn't rely on the contemporary frameworks and concepts and what have you that were anti-racist or anti-oppression and whatever to deal with it either. And so that was in about 2014. Was when I had already been questioning privilege the year prior and what have you. But it was in 2014 that I made a hard shift to theoretically to really trying to delve into Marxism and the like. And my old editing partner, Drew Franklin, over at Orchestrated Pulse, we were making a similar shift at the same time. And so all the work that we were doing was reflecting this kind of, because we had met during Occupy. All the work that we were doing was trying to theorize, like, dang, he lives in his mom's basement. I'm broke working at the Gap now, you know? Like, we did all this activist stuff, and we can't survive. So this isn't working. How can we actually think through the reality that we are minnows in this game, and there's sharks out here? There's forces at work that that like have borderline hegemony in the, not only in an activist scene, but and not only culturally, but like socially, like politically, economically, and that the modes of resistance that we have taken up to this point are inadequate for addressing the needs that we have personally and that we have collectively. So we began making the shift, and it was through that work, through reading with him, you know, talking about Marxism more deeply, really like getting, basically we created a cocoon for ourselves where we like talked all the time about these very issues. And then we tried stuff like he ran for a city council in DC. I went to go work at a union. Like we, and then like based on these conversations and this work that we had been doing to try to like make meaning out of, the collapse of collectivity. And that's kind of been the mission. And that's like why I'm saying it's when I said in the, what I said in the beginning is that it's about humility, right? Like everything that I'm saying is I have failed. I've made mistakes. I've got things wrong. And here are reasons why. You know, there are certain theoretical assumptions that I was making that were just bad assumptions. There are bad theories that I had taken up that I was doing that informed the actions I was taking that led to me failing. I failed. And so I'm saying, like, that's what I'm trying to point out to other people is if you take up this kind of anti-blackness or what have you, you will fail. So, for example, anti-blackness is related to Afro-pessimism, right? And like, and how I describe Afro-pessimism is, I mean, I think you have to look at Frank Wilderson's work, and that's why I was talking about ontology in the piece, because it's like they're taking, they have this concept, and I want to give a vulgar articulation of this rather than like a, you know, I could be far more precise in my descriptions, but I just want to be clear. Yeah. So basically they operate, what unifies it as a theory is the assumption of social debt, that blackness as social debt. This is, I first read about this over a decade. Death. Yeah. Like, and, yeah. And that's the ontology of it. That's the nature of the being, of blackness. And so I first came across that concept through Orlando Patterson's work when over a decade ago, when I was studying slavery under Professor Harry Williams at Carleton College. And we read this other book called Roll Jordan Roll, The World the Slaves Made by Eugene Genovese. And we read another book called The Slave Community by John Blasingame. Like, things that talked about who slaves actually were, you know, and that it wasn't this, it rejects this idea of social death, which in fact, like when we study the historiography of slavery, like social death as a concept is something that white people were saying about slaves in the history. Like, I believe U.B. Phillips and like all of these like just raging racists had an idea that like black people had their personalities destroyed. That was, I believe, I am forgetting these people's names. I'm pretty sure it's not Stanley Elkins, but he, there are these different histories. There's this movement through history where the first idea is that black people are subhuman and therefore they should be enslaved. And then there's this idea that like, no, they're not subhuman. It's that the institution of slavery destroyed their personalities. And so, they lack any like meaningful culture. Then there's like this revision of that that says, no, here's the world that the slaves made. Here's all the cult that, and this is Genovese's point, that there's a, he brings in this dialectical dialectic between the master and the slave. He's saying that they're mutually shaping each other in this dialectical process, and that the slaves are vital to understanding the institution of slavery. So they do make meaning. They do have value. They do, you know, whatever. They are alive. Then you have like Blasingame talking about the slave community, where he's saying, okay, there's this dynamic, but he's also drawing out, here's all the cultural innovations that black slaves had, even under the barbarity of slavery. So no, they are not socially dead. Like, and we stop there pretty much. Like, we stopped at that point where it's like, duh, black slaves were not socially dead. But then it wasn't until after that class that I started discovering this Afro-pessimism stuff. I'm like, what? No, this goes against like this whole history. I thought we settled this, but there's been this revision that has taken back up not only an idea of social death historically, like in the context of slavery, but they draw it like to today. And I'm like, nah, you can't do that, because not only was it not true under slavery, it's certainly not true today. And the reason for understanding that is to understand race as an ideology and understand its connection to class politics, like that it is class politics. And like, that means it's in motion. So for example, what ended slavery? It wasn't a race war, you know, it was a class struggle between various forces, between like the slaveholding elites, the people dependent on them, the manufacturing class, railroads, financiers, like the banks wanting to have access to the South, railroads wanting to have access to the South, and like all of these different interests within the social reproduction of the society, which is fundamentally a question of how are resources extracted? How are things made and distributed? You know, those are the foundational questions. Like if you don't see that, and then you just see this like transhistorical anti-black metaphysical stuff, like you're going to be completely unable to build the forces necessary to contest this stuff. So that was like my initial exposure to Afro-pessimism. Now, again, like there's a ton of different people. They believe, there's some people like, yes, it's about the end of the world. And I said this earlier, that like a Marxist, my understanding is that I'm pushing for the social transformation of the world, this isn't just a semantic shift, like because they like do not care about coming up with solutions. They will very much so claim that as their ethos. Like, it's not about actually trying to win. It's about tearing everything down. But then they don't even take up the means to do that. So, because that requires collectivity and coalition, which is something they fundamentally don't believe in anyway. So it's like, what is the point of this, like this set of ideas? So
it's like, it's a mood or a style.
Yeah. Yeah. I describe it as a mood.
Yeah.
That, and a bad mood.
It's a bad mood. But yeah,
it's a bad mood.
I want to tell a little kind of side story here. My father-in-law, is a big Civil War buff and, has some Southern roots, and he, for a long time, would say things. I mean, he seemed progressive most of the time, but then he would say something crazy like, George Wallace did nothing wrong. You know, I was like, you know, or not quite that, but kind of. And I was like, oh my God. But then he started reading Marx about 3 years ago. And he told me, like, last time I saw him, he said, yeah, you know, I read Marx on the Civil War, and I realized, like, I've been fucked up for years. Like, my whole way of thinking was totally wrong.
It was a battle to socially transform the world as it existed then. Okay. And now that it was to finalize the full ushering in of capitalism. And like slavery had been essential for its development, you know, in the development of the world market. Genovese goes into this in detail in like slavery and bourgeois I think it's Slavery and Bourgeois Property or something like that. It's a really good book, but like I think that's perfect. That's a perfect story that you just told, because it goes against the idea that was articulated when I was talking about intersectionality, the idea that the Combahee River Collective says, which is like, oh, we're in agreement that he's right about this specific stuff at a specific time in a specific place. And they're conceptualizing him as like only in Europe a long time ago. And like that totally discounts the work that he even did on the Civil War, which he was obsessed with. Okay. And he very much so had concepts that talked about the function of colonialism in the accumulation of capital globally, like, and the slave society as being a huge part of that. So it's like, what are you talking about? Like, why, what is this project really that is going on now? And I'm more sympathetic to intersectionality than I am to Afro-pessimism. But Afro-pessimism, like, the reason why I hate it, I mean, I hate it. I don't hate it as much as, like, some other people that I know. I don't hate it as much as some other people, but I hate it nonetheless. I'm not, because I hate it enough to, like, know what it is and to know why it's garbage, but, like, and to have like that opinion. But like, there are people I know that like, they dig deep. They can quote chapter and verse for everything. Okay. So I'm not to that level, but I will say, like, here's some of the reasons why I criticize it. And this, of course, is not in the article, but it's implied. So, well, some of it's in the article. So let's start with like what's in the actual article. I say that I quote like, Wilderson's work on Gramsci, right? And in that text, Wilderson is saying that cows in a slaughterhouse don't care or are totally unaffected by whether or not there's a proletarian revolution and the workers control the slaughterhouse now and like whatever. They don't care because they're still cows. They exist outside the realm of civil society. They exist outside the, you know, the revolution.
Right.
Okay.
So black because people not are human. Cows? Is that what he says?
That is what he says. That's what I quote in the article.
Right.
I'm saying, like, he is saying that class relations, the proletarian revolution, whatever, exists on a distinct plane from that, from racism, from the condition, because he says it's an ontological pivot. He's saying that black people are socially dead, which means that the relations, it's like a cow is socially dead.
How did he come to that? Why did he come to that conclusion?
I don't know. You'd have to ask this brother. Like, I don't know. Okay. Because it doesn't make sense. All right. And I'm going to tell you why. And this is not in the article. I'm going to tell you why. You know, his own biography. And now I am not one to say, go around saying kumbaya, everything's better. I'm not one to say that. Like, this society is racist. And it's barbarous in its treatment of black people. But not all black people all the time. Okay. And in that sense, yes, it's better. The life chances of people, incredibly poor black people now are actually better than, under chattel slavery. Like that.
Yeah. I don't
let's
think that's
keep
really,
it 100.
That's not a controversial.
No, it is controversial. It is controversial because there are people that say that nothing has changed, and many of them do so in the name of Afro-pessimism. So Wilderson is talking about this social death and, you know, all this stuff, right? Talking about cows in a slaughterhouse. Fam, my man's brother is an actor. My man Wilderson's brother was on Seinfeld.
Whoa.
Seinfeld is the whitest show of the 90s.
It's the most Jewish show. Let's give it a little bit of ethnic care.
Yeah, you're right. Look. On that show, that great show, The People vs. OJ, that came out last year, there is a scene in which the jurors on the OJ trial were fighting. They were racially divided. All the black people, there was one TV. All the black people wanted to watch Martin. All the white people wanted to watch Seinfeld. And it was heated. Okay, that's how white Seinfeld was, okay, and is, all right? And Wilderson's brother was on this show, okay? I'm sure, I don't know his financial situation, but I'm pretty sure he's getting residual checks from this Seinfeld work he did. Okay, this show is syndicated. Cow in a slaughterhouse? Come on.